You're listening to the Cannabis Investing Network. Before we begin, a short disclaimer. The full disclaimer follows at the end of this episode. This podcast is a general communication and is being provided for entertainment and information purposes only. It is educational in nature and is not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment strategy, plan, feature, or other purpose. Please enjoy responsibly. Hello and welcome back to the Cannabis Investing Network podcast. My name is Manish, and today I am joined by the king of summer himself, live from the USA. His name is Abby.
There you go, baby. What's going on?
too hot. Coming in hot.
Coming in hot. It's, I'm in the northeastern states, and it's like 30, well, I guess it's in America, it's like 95 degrees Fahrenheit and humid. So it is coming in hot.
How you doing, Abby?
Really good, man. Really good. All things considered with what's going on in the market. I'm on a little bit of a trip right now, a little bit of business, a little bit of pleasure. Mm-hmm. And it's great to travel. I feel pretty well rested. It's very exciting. And I think we'll share some of the stories. What about you? I know things have been pretty hectic on your end there.
Yeah, a lot going on. And, as people can tell, we're on a bit of a summer schedule right now with the podcast. So kind of switching over to every other week because, you know, we're just out living life a little bit, you know. And
I was going to say it's more of a bear market schedule. Yeah.
That's right. We're hiding.
We're hibernating.
I like that. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, one thing I noticed, too, was also that the number of listeners hasn't necessarily changed, but people are taking longer to listen to an episode. So whereas people would maybe listen to something within 2 or 3 days, they might now listen to it, you know, the week after. So it also just makes sort of more sense to do less episodes in the summer when, you know, everyone, I think, is understandably enjoying a little bit more. They're out a little bit more. And certainly with, you know, the chaos of the last few weeks in the markets, I think people are also maybe less focused on, you know, their cannabis investments and more focused on, you know, some of the other things going on in their lives. So I know it's certainly been that way for me on the real estate side. We've really just been heads down trying to, you know, work out whatever deals we can and get deals closed because, you know, the market has still been pretty robust.
Yeah, once you go into summer, things start to lull off a little bit. But, you know, all I took away from you from that statement was that the level of analytics that you have... For our listeners, I don't know, you know, you're just like, well, listen, it's mostly blood type O that listen to us, right? Sometimes blood type B, they typically fall on this thing, but no, you're 100% right. Right.
You know, I text them by name and I'm like, hey, Mark, you haven't listened to these, to your episode this week. Everything okay? Did I say something wrong last week?
Yeah, exactly. Just so you know, I still know the last 3 digits of your social insurance number or social security number. You know,
ad tracking is real.
Yeah. But the summer lulls are definitely kicking in. And even on my side, everyone's trying to get their deals put across before this weekend. Because typically, you know, there's the old adage, sell in May, go away. And in this case, I think people did actually go away.
Yeah, sell in May and come back never again, apparently, is how we're playing this time.
Yeah, exactly. New phone, who dis, right? Yeah. Every single time. It's like, hey,
that's right. New portfolio.
Exactly. Yeah, no, cannabis investor? No, that's not me.
You know, so it's funny you say that, right? Because I would say most, like in real estate, you know, summer slows down a lot, right? But our deal cycles are pretty long. So we're closing deals today that maybe were cut, you know, 3 months ago, 6 months ago, something like that, maybe a year ago, even depending on, you know, if you have a long closing. And you're right. A lot of times people, we think about it, we go, hey, we want to get stuff done right now because in July and August, things will really slow down because people will go away on vacation to the cottage, whatever. Right. But that probably will still happen. But what I'm saying is, the market actually is changing rapidly before us, and people's expectations are changing. So people I'm talking to, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day and they're like, we're like, hey, this is a good deal. Hopefully we can get it across the line. And the guy says to me, yeah, it'll be our last one for a while. And he's joking, you know, he's kidding, but we're kind of like, oh, I don't know how much we're joking. Right. Because
there's a little bit of truth in every joke. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And so you know, part of that is that we're looking at the market and it's really changing quite rapidly. And we're worried that the transaction volume is going to dry up because unlike the public markets, private assets like commercial real estate, there hasn't been really a price adjustment, maybe a little bit, maybe definitely softening of the buyer pool. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, if that incremental buyer who's still doing deals kind of goes away or takes a step back, the market could really slow down while we wait for sellers to readjust their prices. And we really haven't seen that yet. So people don't want deals hanging out there for long periods of time right now. People mm-hmm. want to get deals done as quickly as they can because they're worried things might change over the next couple months.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that because I mean, I've been obviously keeping a close eye, I'm using air quotes here, on real estate, especially residential and a little bit on the commercial side. And, you know, I started seeing houses in my neighborhood start going up for sale. They were a little bit longer. Then I started seeing open houses for those houses. And I see a couple more signs. And then I see new price signs. And then finally, some are starting to sell below market, right? Or below whatever the listed price was. And so, sure. I mean, obviously, there's really no data points that I could kind of really go to. But every realtor that I've spoken with have kind of reiterated what you were saying, that, hey, look, you know, houses are staying on the markets for a lot longer. People aren't showing up for bidding wars as they were before. Mm-hmm. And the pricing that we were expecting, we're just not really getting, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that could be for an ample number of reasons, but interest rates probably being the main one.
Yeah, I mean rates, expectations, right? I mean, all these things are tied together.
Yeah. You're 100% right on expectations, right? I think the market kind of got a little wild there. And, you know, we've talked about that about a couple of times, but it's good to see that, you know, you're still getting the deals across the line.
Well, you know, TBD, but that's what's been keeping us busy for now. So a lot of things to talk about today. We're going to cover a bunch of topics and try to, you know, hit on a lot of things. So we're going to try to keep it moving. So first things first, I think it's, you know, it's really important to talk about the macro picture. Mm-hmm. And so now for the third time, let me get back into my analogy. Okay. So Abby, if you will, you're at the bar. The drinks are flowing. The music is playing. You're having a good time. But eventually, this party will end. And the first time we did this analogy, I think was about 8 weeks ago. I think it was about kind of early April was the first time that I came up with this analogy. And the idea was that things are pretty good. The music's flowing. The music's playing. You know, last call has happened, which was QE ending at the end of March. But we're still sipping those final drinks. You know, it still feels like a party. And things hadn't really taken a turn yet. The second time we used this analogy was maybe a couple weeks later. You know, sort of the music was dying out. Some people have started to leave. But there was, you know, enough going on that people were still hanging around and didn't want to leave the party. Mm-hmm. In the last few weeks, I would say from the beginning of June to really middle of June. So I'm talking, you know, between 2 and 4 weeks ago and really pretty abruptly 2 weeks ago, the music stopped, the lights came on, and staff started pushing people towards the exits. And once people realized what was happening, there was a pretty quick movement by investors for the exits. And it feels like pretty quickly people realized that, hey, we got to leave here and all of the Ubers are on surcharge. And what are we going to do? So I would say in the last few weeks, what we've seen is, you know, because of inflation, because of expectations around rates, the bonds, the 10-year bond has absolutely surged. Investors have really been pretty panicked. And we've seen a lot of pencils down, quote unquote, from some pretty sophisticated investors and lenders in the real estate market, mm-hmm. as they sort of try to adjust now and figure out what the new normal is. And the only other period that I've seen in my 10 years in the market like this was the very beginning of COVID, where things changed very quickly and everybody kind of took a step back and started saying, okay, what does this mean? How do we readjust? You know, what is our new reality, right? Which way is up? And that's been a pretty sudden and scary change only in the last few weeks.
Gotcha. To take your analogy one step further, you know, the people are in like Uber surcharges figuring where to go, and they're showing up to Alcoholic Anonymous meetings, right? Being like, hey, my name's Abby. I used to be a growth investor. Hi, Abby. Welcome.
That's good.
It wasn't until I found value.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Well, you know, I don't even know that value is a good place to hide right now. But sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're really anything with a liquidity component, there's really definitely not a good place to hide. I mean, you know, I at least, I don't know. That's my sort of take on it as well.
Well, so far, the private markets have been relatively steady, right? They've been relatively unaffected, to your point, because there's people can't panic sell, right? There's not a there's not a huge amount of liquidity for these assets. But and we'll get into this a little bit later when we talk about kind of strategies, but I think that's going to go next, right? I just think that something has to give here on these private assets, where your financing is twice as expensive as it was 6 months ago. You know, like that has to have some impact, right? Even though prices might be sticky downwards, eventually we're going to feel it.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, look, listen, I have some experience in the private markets for both on the equity raising side, as well as being an equity investor, as well as, like, you know, buying, selling certain assets. One thing that I'll say about as an investor, so like I invested in a couple of private tech companies back in mid to late 2020, right? One of them was a company called Impossible Foods. And basically, it was an opportunity to buy into the company privately. They were looking to go public this year. They've actually pushed back their liquidity date, and they're buying up the shares that they sold to us. They said, hey, if you want some sort of liquidity, here's a schedule. And it's actually still at a premium to what we paid.
Interesting.
So I've seen that aspect of it. The other side that I've seen is there's a couple private companies where I call them and I say, hey, do you think that there's going to be a liquidity event? Like, how are you guys doing in terms of cash? Are you going to have a raise pretty soon? They're not too worried about the cash position, but they're not offering any liquidity terms. Like, they don't have a credit facility or anything to buy back those shares, right? Or they're like, hey, if you can find another buyer on your own, like in a gray market trade, there's brokers that do that. As long as we approve both transactions, we'll let you do that, right? Which is also something that I found kind of unique in this market right now, because I figured people would just be like, hey, no, you can't sell your private shares right now. It's just the way that it is. But they're like, yeah, if you want to sell them and you can broker your own transaction,
right,
you can go ahead and do it.
But you could always sort of do that, right? I mean, they have to approve it, but you know, and just to give you another anecdote, there was a company we invested in privately that's like a real darling, and I won't say the name, but it doesn't really matter. It's just more of an example. Like, and they have had no trouble raising money, right? Money just thrown at them. Mm-hmm. And last year, you know, they raised a round. Basically, they said that, you know, a couple investors came to them privately, like institutions just came to them and they just raised the money, right? Like, didn't even blink. And so every time we've asked, they'd be like, no, we're good on money. And then we actually had an email last year that was like, hey, if you guys want to sell some, here's a chance to get liquidity because the demand is so much so that we'd like to be able to, you know, give you guys some, you know, basically give.
They don't want to issue new shares. They don't want to issue new shares.
Exactly.
Right?
Or they didn't want to increase the round or whatever, right? They wanted, so they came to us saying, if you guys want to sell. Anyway, we just got an email last week being like, oh, good news. You know, we're raising a new round and we're actually going to be able to let you guys participate this time. Right. And so translation is, hey, markets have changed. Not so easy to raise money anymore. So, you know, we suddenly would like you guys to put money in, not take money out. Right.
Yeah,
so, so just like that to me feels pretty typical of kind of what is going on. I think what you mentioned about the Impossible guys willing to buy up shares, that's pretty exceptional to me. I think that's a pretty rare circumstance.
I shouldn't say it was Impossible, like the actual management team that came back to us and said they wanted to buy us shares, because they're such a large company. I've never even talked to them. It was the group that sold it to us.
Oh, cool. Okay. Got it.
Come back and buy the shares. Yeah.
Got it. Interesting. So now what, right? So this metaphor is basically, you know, played itself out. I think it's basically done. So where are we now, right? And one thing I would really recommend people track, you know, if you track sort of the S&P every day, one good thing to look at is the 10-year bond. And a lot of people just don't really care about bond rates because, you know, I mean, the average person's not buying bonds, right? But it's just it just bears repeating that the 10-year bond rate, you know, that's the risk-free rate. That's gravity in the world of investing. So when you look at kind of early to mid-June and you just look at bonds blasting off, just shooting upwards, that trepidation, that fear in the marketplace for bonds spills over into all the other assets.
Yeah. So, and it's one thing, Manish, mm-hmm. to really, it's important to note when you're saying the 10-year bond, you're talking about the U.S. bonds, right? Not Europe, not Canada, like the U.S. 10-year treasuries.
Sure. But it, like, for example, if you notice the Canadian and the U.S. 10-year, they move very closely, right? So bond, and I don't know, I don't track, you know, European bonds,
yeah,
but
yeah.
I would imagine bonds around the world sort of have a high correlation to each other, but I don't know, right?
Yeah, but like usually, just the risk-free rate, you know. You
right, that. Right. Yeah. And I would say U.S. 10-year is the one to look at for sure,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So what I would say is that the reason that you had such a fast movement was because of the CPI prints. And when it comes down to it, you know, it comes down to food and fuel. Right. Or I've heard people say gas and groceries. And those things are just having such a major pinch on everybody's wallet that until fuel or gas comes down, it's really hard to see inflation coming down across the board. And the Fed had given pretty clear guidance that, you know, the next couple hikes were going to be 50 basis points. Mm-hmm. And you know, when the bonds were really ripping, I was talking to a friend of mine who understands these things much better than I do. And he was saying, look, I mean, CPI is so out of control. The Fed has to do 75 bips or even more to get this under control and restore credibility. And lo and behold, that's what they did. Right. They had given pretty good forward guidance for 50 and they changed that to 75 on the fly. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. just shows you how kind of serious the situation is. Right. So I think that is really important for equity investors to understand because, to me, when I'm looking at this, like we're still in the beginning phases of all this, right? The markets, the public markets are very good at pricing in forward news, you know, 6 months or whatever. But there's, in my opinion, it feels like there's still a lot of room for things to give and things really need to break. Something really has to change before we can fix this inflation problem. And I think that unfortunately from a macro perspective is pretty bad news for investors pretty much across the board.
Yeah. And even in the last meeting, like Powell did allude to that they could do the same rate hike again.
I mean, I would be surprised if they didn't do 75 again, right? I mean,
yeah.
At the end of the day, 50 to 75, you know, 25 bips, you know, when inflation is running at, you know, call it 7%. You're supposed to be real interest rates are, nominal interest rates minus inflation. Meaning yeah. if you're borrowing money now at 5 to 6%, but inflation is 7, your real interest rate is still negative mm-hmm. 1, -2, right? So that's still a problem, right? So rates have to go even higher to compensate for that. Now, you know, is inflation going to stay this high? Is it already peaked? I mean, these are all great questions that nobody really knows the answer to, right? And, mm-hmm. and you know, if there's some kind of light at the end of the tunnel of the Russia-Ukraine situation and, you know, it looks like oil can kind of come back down, then again, there's some more flexibility there. So maybe it doesn't have to go that much higher. But, you know, these interest rate increases, it's very, very real. And I think this is really going to have a hurting on the economy. But Abby, you and I were talking about this earlier. The Main Street consumer is not really feeling it yet. Like it's still pretty much business as usual for the average person.
They're definitely not even feeling it. They have no idea what's going on. And actually, they're acting the exact opposite that you would expect somebody to act right now. Like they're going out and spending. And I can elaborate a little bit about
that. Yeah, please, please.
And so, you know, I've been traveling a little bit the last week or so. Mm-hmm. And some of it was a little bit close to where I was going, so I had to rent a car and I had to drive. Was driving my car on the 401. This is in Toronto, and leaving the city, absolutely packed. Like mm-hmm. I'm talking, just like it was bumper to bumper. that I hit traffic in a whole bunch of different areas. And I was like, okay, this could just be normal traffic, like city traffic, even though it was outside of rush hour. Keep going. Still same thing. Airports, exact same thing. Like, I'm getting bumped in seats. Lineups are really long. A whole bunch of things. People are going out, like dining. There was a restaurant down. This is specifically in Toronto. Mm-hmm. This is also in New York as well. There's a couple of restaurants that just weren't accepting. Like, they were like, hey, sorry, like, you know, it's 2 or 2.5 hour wait, right? It's like, not really going to wait 2.5 hours for a meal because I'm kind of hungry now. 2.5 hours.
And that was the McDonald's.
Yeah, exactly. Believe it or not. Yeah.
Every fucking dining experience of New York.
Well, hey, when you give McDonald's that much money, all right, they make sure there's a table for you within 2 hours.
They hook it up.
Yeah. but yeah, so I mean, like, look, I really don't think that the measures to curb inflation have really hit Main Street. And that's, look, that's a very small sample population of, like, just Northeast, like Toronto and like upstate New York, and then a little bit in New York City as well. So, like, I haven't gone, to like Oklahoma or California lately, or even Florida. So, like, I don't know what those areas are doing, or even what Europe
is
doing.
Sure. But summertime are spending months, right? Especially in the Northeast where we don't get much summer.
Exactly.
You know, there's a lot of pent up demand. People want to go out and do things. And certainly the prices are up, right? But it hasn't really tempered demand. You know,
gas prices. Okay. So the one thing everybody is complaining about on Main Street is gas prices, but it's not enough to change their behavior.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, I'm still seeing people, I'm seeing people drive. Like, I was at a mall here in the States, absolutely packed. We couldn't find parking. And, you know, like, it's just people are out and about, right?
Yeah.
Like,
absolutely. So anecdotally, right? I mean, it just, people's behavior hasn't really changed. Maybe it's changed on the margins and stuff like that. But the point being that, you know, it's same thing when you look at, you know, labor, right? Like, there's just still a tremendous shortage of labor kind of across the board. Mm-hmm. And some of it, by the way, I think is long-term. I think long-term structurally, like, I always go back to this. I look at construction because that's a world that I know pretty well on the mm-hmm. you know, real estate side, like building, you know, condos or apartment houses or whatever. And there's just not enough labor, I think. Like, I think just looking at it, demographically, like, there's not enough trades, there's not enough people for all the work that needs to be done. And I think so you have these kind of, I think, longer term now structural problems of it's going to get really hard to fill jobs. And I think that it's very hard to have wage deflation. So which is maybe a good thing, right? The consumer has more money in their pocket if they're working. But the stagflation scenario makes a lot of sense. Like, prices aren't coming down yet. Mm-hmm. It's going to take a lot for them to come down. And yet running a business, making a profit, I think has gotten harder in a lot of ways. Right. So I think, you know, to your point, Abby, like, the average person doesn't have a stock portfolio. The average person mm-hmm. doesn't own Bitcoin. The average person maybe has a house and the value of that house has come down marginally. You know, maybe not incredibly yet, but that's probably going to be the first thing that really puts pressure on the average person's when the value of their house comes down and they feel less wealthy, they're not able to refinance at low rates. That's probably going to be the first thing that really affects spending.
Okay, gotcha. The last thing you said there of them being able to refinance at a low rate, because I was like, who knows what the price of their house actually is, right? People have an idea of it, but it's mm-hmm. it's just. Like, in your head.
Well, that's it. And people don't unlock the value. Well, some people sell their house, right? But they have to usually live somewhere else. So people unlock a lot of value by refinancing their house and taking out that equity. And in the US, you get a 30-year mortgage, fixed rate, right? So you get a, you know, 3% 30-year mortgage. That's an incredibly good piece of paper. But
yeah,
you get that money, you know, it sits in your bank account, you feel really rich. You go do something with it, right? Maybe you renovate your house, maybe you travel, maybe you invest it, who knows? But once that money is gone, that's kind of it, right? You kind of shot your shot and there's not really an opportunity to refi anymore. And in fact, if you want to, you know, buy a new house or whatever, you know, then you start feeling the pain of the rate, of the 30-year rate being more like, you know, 5.5% from 3%, right?
Yeah, 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 absolutely. And then, I mean, I think you touched on it really good there in terms of, you know, there being a lack of staff. That could be a reason for these long waits that, like, you know, I'm experiencing, that you're experiencing. But the question that I kind of asked myself again is, like, why aren't people returning to work? And it's just exactly like you're saying. I think it's more because of the warm weather. And so do you as well. There's summertime, you know, where people sell in May, go away. People want to just take some time off. We are coming off a really unprecedented, like, stressful time. It's great to kind of be back out there. But, you know, I think people still have discretionary income left. They're still spending it. It had, like, they haven't really gotten hit with it yet. And I don't think they realize how bad it could possibly be. So I know a lot of people typically look at September or Q4 and they're like, hey, Q4 is typically a really good quarter. I'm actually more pessimistic about this fall than I am optimistic.
Yeah, look, I think generally speaking, if we look forward, I think, you know, using that sort of analogy that we had, you know, about last call and people sipping their drinks, I mean, the consumer is still feeling pretty good, right? So I think that, you know, people have their jobs, they've probably had some wage growth, you know, their wallet is being pinched, but maybe they're able to dip into some savings, maybe they're using their credit more, right?
Yeah.
They haven't really readjusted their behavior downwards. And I think it'll just take time, right? Every asset of their life is getting more expensive, and anything that involves financing, like if you have a auto loan or something like that, that they're going to feel the pinch of that, right? So across the market, I feel that we're entering a time of price rediscovery, where people are trying to figure out what is the right multiple to put on these assets. So certainly in real estate, that's a conversation that we're having a lot. That we use cap rates, and we feel some people I've talked to also feel that we should be underwriting at more conservative, at higher cap rates. So we demand higher yields on properties. The market is not necessarily there yet. It's moved a little bit, but not a lot. But I think that's inevitable, right? And then the second piece is, what is the normalized earnings for some of these companies, right? Companies have had really strong earnings over the last 2 years. Q2 will probably also be very strong. What are these earnings normalized to now that there's not all this stimulus effect of fiscal stimulus and monetary stimulus, right? If we enter a recession, which seems kind of almost unavoidable at this point, what are the recession earnings of these companies going to be, right? And I think that's kind of the forward-looking stuff that is being priced into the market day by day, but I think that's another shoe to drop that hasn't really dropped yet.
Yeah, and I think only a small percentage of the people are actually doing that, right? Because it goes back to what we're seeing on Main Street. And, you know, to continue with that analogy that you started with the bar, it's like, look, people had all those drinks and now they're feeling buzzed and they're feeling good. That hangover hasn't set in yet, right? And I think that hangover is going to come in September, personally, or Q4 of this year.
Right. I would say over the last few weeks, I do think things have changed. Back to our old favorite, THC, things have changed. But it's the rate of change on the bonds that really spooked a lot of people. So remember, the bond market is like exponentially larger than the equity market. So it's important to remember that, right? This is the biggest flows of money in the world go into these bonds. What some of the largest investors of the world are thinking. That's what these bonds are telling you. And you know, the 10-year rate going from 2.8, 2.9 to basically, 3.5% over 2 weeks, that is a massive move. That's like a 20% price adjustment on bonds. Now, you're a cannabis investor, you say, well, 20%, okay, you lose 20% in 2 weeks, boo-hoo, right? We do that. That's like a good 2 weeks for us, right? But you remember, bond investors are buying this instrument to earn 3% a year for 10 years. Their entire nominal return over 10 years is 30%, okay? So when they lose 20% face value, right? But when their portfolio goes down 20% in 2 weeks, they just lost 6 years of return in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So that's a big deal for them, right? That really spooks them. And that's part of where the sell-off comes from. So I think that's really concerning. And I think what happens is, the way I think about this market is fits and starts, is we, you know, we have these really big drawdowns that happen quickly, and then they kind of, you know, gets a bit oversold, and it recovers over, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. And then same thing happens again, right? So we, and each time we're kind of finding a new low as we go. So I just think it's really important to say, like, this is really, in my opinion, rediscovery. Some assets on the private side really haven't adjusted at all yet. I think the good news, you know, to talk about cannabis, is cannabis is actually, to me, looking pretty good. Like, we've had some serious public market revaluations. Your, you know, largest companies are trading at, you know, sub 6x EBITDA on average. GTI is in the single digits now for their share price. So, and the estimates have all been brought down across the board over the last two quarters for these companies. And I think earnings will start to do well again with New Jersey, Q2, Q3, et cetera, right? Seasonal adjustments, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about recession earnings, like, recession is bad for everybody, don't get me wrong. But again, like, I think cannabis will prove to be a pretty resilient CPG staple type product as opposed to a discretionary product. So I think these companies, from a fundamental perspective, are actually going to maybe slightly, but outperform what the expectations are going forward, while the rest of the market, I think, is going to have a lot more headwinds against it. And now you could argue that fundamentals don't matter right now and nobody cares. And you know, I don't know, right? I mean, we'll see. But I mean, that's at least a positive of what I'm seeing. You have much lower valuations, much lower expectations, and I think relatively good outlook for earnings going into the future.
Yeah, and you know, as a sector, you're right. I agree with you on cannabis. You know, we saw this happen with March 2020. Using that as a barometer, we did see cannabis sales go up, and I think you're 100% right. It's going to be seen more as a consumer staple as opposed to consumer discretionary. Also, medical cannabis, you know, people aren't going to stop buying their medicine.
Yeah.
But the one thing I will just caveat when thinking about it this way, and this is kind of just for my own sake, more or less, I just want to share it, is that yes, the sector could do well, but there are names that could perform poorly, because, you know, for sure, it is still very important to know, you know, if a sector is going up, it's like, you know, the company that you own, can they potentially participate in it? Right. Yep. Like, for example, if they don't have exposure to New York or sorry, to New Jersey, then they can't participate in that new market being unlocked. Obviously that part makes sense. Right. And the reason I bring this up, and, you know, I just see a lot of news on Europe right now, and they're going kind of back to like how big the European market, et cetera, is. And I just kind of go back to, you know, can a company actually capture that market share? And then as well, you know, when you did mention that recessions are bad for all companies, they're especially bad for unprofitable companies burning cash that are pretty small. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we do go into a recession, I would definitely not treat every cannabis company the same. It'll be even more paramount to be a stock picker as opposed to like just sector rotating. Right.
Totally. And let's actually talk about strategy. Right. And so let's talk, we're going to talk broadly and also about cannabis. And what I'm seeing is, you know, I'm still seeing some really interesting deals on the real estate side cross my desk. So I just said there's a lot of smart people who are pens down. And the smartest investors, the ones who I like kind of have the most respect for, what I've learned from them is they never stop looking. And, you know, they have their own underwriting metrics. They're conservative. You know, they want to get a good deal, but they keep putting offers in and keep finding ways to be creative. So, you know, I had one deal cross my desk where I was like, wow, you know, this seems like a really good opportunity. And the story was that somebody else had it tied up, you know, they dropped it because of, you know, changes in financing. Mm-hmm. And the vendor's motivated, has owned it for a long time, has a low cost base. And he came to, you know, my guy, because my guy basically emphasized the fact that he can move quickly and is willing to close the deal cash. And basically, you know, hey, I'm giving you a little bit less money, but I'm going to be able to move on this thing. Right. So those are the kind, and same thing, you know, another investor, I remember, did a deal right right kind of as in the height of the uncertainty of COVID, in that kind of April, May, June timeframe, was able to snag a deal that in hindsight was an excellent deal, just because there was so much uncertainty in that time and a lot of investors were pens down. They weren't even looking. And he was kind of one of the first deals I saw after the COVID pause, right? So the reason I'm telling you that is to say that when everyone else is kind of sick of the market or scared, that's when good opportunities emerge, but selectively. And you need to still be smart about what you're doing, right? And certainly from a strategy perspective, there's a high optionality value of holding cash. So don't go out and spend everything you have in one place. But especially in public markets, which readjust and remark every day, I think on big red days, which I think you could see some coming up, in the near future, those are days you want to be looking at things and maybe nipping, kind of nibbling away at things, just a little bit here and there, and where you kind of find your spots, right? Understanding that things can still go lower, of course they always can, but a good deal is still a good deal.
Absolutely. Absolutely, especially if you know how to identify a good deal, and it's just like, it's kind of like what you said there about your top investors or the guys that you really admire. They don't stop looking. Well, guess what? The competition is less fierce in a bad market too.
Totally,
right?
Totally. And the sellers are more
not telling you. Sorry, right. I was going to say your hairdresser is not telling you, hey, you should buy XYZ stock.
That's a little callback to Abby's first big stock pick.
Yeah, exactly. I still have that on my. On one of my accounts, to remind me.
Just a reminder. Well, yeah. And the thing too is it doesn't need to be so, I do think it becomes a stock picker's market when things really go down. But, that being said, I have no exposure to technology companies, right? And so when things really get slammed, I go, maybe I should just buy an index of SaaS companies, maybe buy a little bit of semi companies, just to have some exposure to that. But I'm not going to be a stock picker in that realm just because I'm not going to invest the time and energy into it. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's where I go, I don't need to pick the best name at the lowest price. If I just pick a general index of high quality names at a reasonable price, that could end up being a good short or long-term hold, depending on what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that's more of a sector rotation in the recession. I'd probably not do that myself. And the only reason why is, when you own that index, let's just say it's a tech index, right? Typically, this is just generalized. Typically, tech names are high growth, high PE, high revenue, low margins. In the beginning until they become really large, like Facebook or Amazon or Microsoft, those guys. A great example of this would have been like Cathie Wood's ARK fund, right? That's like a tech name. That's getting hammered across the board.
Right? Yeah, I would just be careful when you say tech, just to, that's a very broad word we're using, right? I mean big established, that's why I said SaaS companies in particular, but big established companies that are, and again, if you don't do the work, you don't even know, right, what's profitable, what's not. But broadly speaking, I'm saying I agree with you. You need to separate between the high cash burn speculative concept companies and what are the established companies that are making
big
money.
Tech. Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Big tech type names that, again, I just have no exposure to. Right. So it's like, hey, these. I'm not saying today necessarily, but when we have drawdowns and people are scared, that's when it gets interesting to get some exposure there.
Mm-hmm. Completely agree with you on that.
So strategy wise, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like public markets, I really like looking for big red days, when people are freaked out. And by the way, I think we could see some pretty scary CPI prints coming up over the next, couple of months. And if that happens, and I think it's more likely to happen than not, I think you're going to get people looking at that Fed funds rate and saying, hey, it has to be higher, right? It has to be, maybe there's two more 75 rate increases coming over the next couple months, right? And so it's those periods of transition and uncertainty. That's usually when the public markets adjust really quickly. And there's some forced liquidations and stuff like that. So it can get pretty interesting. That being said, I think the real pain in terms of cleaning up a lot of this mess, I think will actually be felt well into next year, because when you have a bull market for so long, talking about my experience in real estate, mm-hmm. people's bad behavior and risk taking kind of gets papered over. So the people who take the most risk typically end up making the most money.
Right.
Right. And they learn all the wrong lessons. And people who are too conservative end up missing out. So now with higher rates, tighter money, that's like, you know, money being sucked out of the system, I do think you're going to have to see some distress. If you look at real estate, you look at cannabis, you look at tech, those three industries, I have not seen a lot of distress yet. Right. So that to me, I look at it and I go, the maximum pain point comes when that distress starts happening. And I think it takes time for that to play out. And I just don't think we're that close yet.
On the cannabis side?
On all of it. On all of it. I mean, look at cannabis. Cannabis has had a bear market in equities for over a year.
Yeah.
And, you know, you and I were talking about this. Most private assets in cannabis still have pretty high valuations and are very sticky, very, very resistant doing a down round. And I kind of look at that and I'm like, how are some of these companies even surviving? I don't know. Right. So that's been kind of surprising to me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I've noticed it in this is, again, very select markets. But there have been a couple markets where if you were to go purchase a license or a paper asset, the prices are still the same as of October 2021. Right. I'm just using that as a benchmark because that was the last time I really looked at that particular market. And they haven't budged at all. Like, I'm talking cultivation licenses, you know, manufacturing licenses, just paper licenses are trading at the exact same price that they were in October till now. And, you know, I've even talked to some of the brokers and I say, hey, how can they kind of justify this? How can the entrepreneur, they're like, oh, well, you know, there's still this conception, misconception actually in mm-hmm. cannabis, from people who are sort of in the industry that everybody in the cannabis industry is somehow wealthy or has money.
Right.
Which could not be further from the truth.
Present company included.
Exclusively. Yeah, exactly. So when I was talking to this broker, they were like, yeah, these are non-cannabis people. They just think that cannabis licenses should be worth a lot more. And I was like, all right, well, I'll call them back in 6 months. And well, this is the 6 month call and they're not budging. So we'll see if they survive within 6 months too, because there are some MSOs who are circling around certain states and they got big cash balances. But you know, I don't know if they're buying or if they're selling or what they're doing specifically.
Well, and, that level. And that cash is precious, right? I mean, I really think companies are gonna like look at 10 deals, like sign 10 LOIs and do one. Because
yes, you hit it right on the head there.
Right? Their cash is precious, their equity is precious because they're you know, it's so depressed. And you know, you're opening yourself up to a big seller, you know, dumping your stock, right?
Yeah.
So even that is its own problem because it stops your ability to do future M&A. So I think right now with the price, and this is why I keep saying to people, you know, like we'll talk about SAFE and uplisting in a second, but I actually think the uplisting is the key to funding the social equity businesses, because when you can buy the big MSOs at sub 6x EBITDA, like next year's EBITDA, there is no private market deal that you can really do. Like, it's just like what are public companies going to do? Like, sorry, what are private companies and social equity companies going to do? Like raise money at 3x EBITDA, mm-hmm. right? It's just, it's very untenable. Like it's a super high cost of capital. And you know, when you look at like, let's look at, for example, Air and Ascend, you know, still sizable public companies, but you know, not the biggest. Those companies, their equity value has shrunk so much. They might, I think they're legitimately like 3x or under future EBITDA, right? And I mean, again, proven entities that are not the big five, but are pretty close. So when those kind of companies are trading there, like what hope does even the best private company have of getting a good valuation? I think it's extremely difficult.
Well, yeah, exactly. They don't, right? There's no one in their sane mind. But a lot of people also don't look at the public comps, right? Especially when you're in these markets when they're just buying paper licenses.
Yeah, I mean, paper license is a bit of a different thing, right?
But
the money for the paper license has to come from somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So that's the genesis of the problem, right?
And there's one other thing that you said about, like, you know, and I know you just anecdotally threw out that number 10 LOIs, but that's a strategy that a lot of these guys use, right? They throw out a bunch of LOIs. They essentially take that asset off the market for a short amount of time because there's typically some sort of exclusivity period, whether it's 30 days, 60 days, whatever.
Sure.
And that's a strategy that I've seen, right? And it's kind of an underhanded strategy, but it's also a strategy for you to hedge that, okay, if there are a lot of other competitors out there, that because you took that asset off the market, it's not going to run up on you, right?
Yeah, sure. But I mean, also, like, to be fair to everybody, like, this happens a lot in real estate too. Like, until you move paper around, you really don't know if there's even a deal to be had, right? All these deals sound great until you start talking about valuation.
Right.
You know, somebody goes, oh yeah, I'll sell maybe around this or maybe around this. And until you paper it, you don't know. And then until you paper it and you have an agreement in principle agreed to, like, why are you going to go spend the money and time and energy and go look under all the rocks, right? Like, you're not going to do, like, everyone is stretched for time and resources. So it's silly to do all that DD up front and go, okay, we really like it. Here's what we can do. And then you go, no, we want double that, right? It's just, okay, we just wasted everybody's time. So this is silly. Right. So I think that I think there's a reason why that M&A is so fraught with issues, especially in our industry, because you know this, right? How many private companies tell you their numbers are one thing, and then you actually get to looking in the financials and it's like a completely different story. And you're like, well, like, and it's not even necessarily that they're trying to mislead you. Sometimes it's just
they don't know.
Sometimes they just don't know, right? And they go, oh no, but you know, this is what it's going to be in the future. And it's like, that's not really the market we're in today.
Exactly.
So talking about legislative cannabis changes. So, you know, today is June 27th. And you know, if you look at two of the biggest political issues in the US right now, you know, we did get that confirmation that the Supreme Court basically overturned Roe v. Wade. And that is going to suck the air out of all of the conversations, I think, across America and even in Canada, right? I mean, that's just such a blow to, you know, women's rights that have been kind of established for like 50 years or something. And you layer that on top of the previous conversation, which was school shootings, which had a huge resurgence over the last few weeks. It doesn't feel like there's a lot of urgency. There's not a lot of, you know, senators pounding the table on cannabis right now, right? I mean, it's just not where the political capital is going to go, which is understandable. I mean, these are some pretty serious issues that you know, people are very sensitive over, understandably so. So that unfortunately puts us kind of well on the back burner, which is kind of ironic because I do feel after the upcoming 22 elections, like, America is just going to need like a big collective hot box session and like a big group hug, because like it's like it's getting pretty fractured out there in terms of, you know, the political parties. I think when you look at things, what's happening, like sort of like the online world, like the commentary is really going downhill. It has been going downhill since COVID, and it's becoming more and more extreme on kind of all sides. People talking past each other, people just really not having any kind of empathy for anyone else's view, and just getting really echo chambered into thinking the other side is, you know, kind of like the enemy, right? As opposed to, you know, your neighbor or whatever, right? So that's not a very conducive environment for coming together and getting things done. But that being said, you know, some positive actually bullets in terms of the legislative side, like Nancy Mace won her primary challenge, right, against a Donald Trump backed Republican. So even in the most right wing primary in South Carolina, they did tag Nancy Mace and try to hit her on cannabis, right? I mean, her opponent came out and said, oh, she was at a cannabis conference in Miami at Benzinga, will she agree to take a drug test? You know, and they tried hitting her on it, didn't work. She won, right? So they're gonna. You better believe the political consultants will make a note of that. Another interesting one is for Senate in Pennsylvania, John Fetterman, who's right now the lieutenant governor, he's very, very pro cannabis. It wants to legalize in PA. very unapologetic about that, is a champion on that. He's going up against Dr. Oz for Senate. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Oz publicly said, I don't think we should legalize cannabis in PA. You know, we don't want people getting high. We want them getting back to work. Mm-hmm. So another really good bellwether of what's going to happen here. I think John Fetterman's a favorite, being, you know, local to PA and all that stuff. But if he's able to beat Dr. Oz, that's another great data point for cannabis. And I'm sure they're going to debate it. I'm sure it's going to come up. So I'm really curious. It'll be a really interesting to watch how that goes down. So politically, some interesting things happening here on the federal side. And sorry, the last one before I forget. Some of the most positive news I've seen on the federal side in a long time was the news about Representative Joyce, who's a Republican in the House, talking to Senator Schumer about some kind of compromise bill. And the discussion seems to be around combining SAFE banking with the HOPE Act. The HOPE Act just provides money for state level expungement, and maybe lumping that in with something to do with, you know, veterans protection, which is, you know, I think we can all agree on, and having some kind of research bill as well, and maybe some SBA loans being made available, especially for social equity. So that's kind of a theoretical package, which is still, I think, a ways off. But that is some of the most promising stuff I've seen so far in terms of the federal side.
Yeah, I mean, there was one other thing. I think it was the CLIMB Act, right? The Capital Lending and Investment for Marijuana Businesses. I saw something in regards to that. But like, look, even though SAFE was sort of stripped out of the America Competes Act, there is still a really big push for banking reform. So, I mean, which is great to see, right? These guys are extremely tenacious, and persistence will persevere eventually, right? That's how Canada became legal. So it's only a matter of time.
Sure. I mean, look, I would say that, look, SAFE and Competes, I don't know why people are getting all excited about this. It wasn't going to happen. Like, they've been pretty clear. They want to introduce the CAOA bill. They want to say they tried on that big bill, even though we all know it's doomed to fail. But, you know, that SAFE Plus kind of pivot that we're all hoping for, you know, there's only maybe another 6 months or so to get that done, right? And there's kind of whispers of that being a lame duck bill. I would plan for that being a pleasant surprise. Like, ultimately, if it gets kicked to the lame duck, like, we all hope it happens, obviously, but there's no guaranteeing it, right? I mean, there's basically, like, even if Schumer wanted it to happen, there's still the possibility that people in the Senate choose to block it or find a procedural way to block it or something, for sure. Right? So they have to be, I think you can't bet on it happening in the lame duck, just even though we know that that is, you know, the prize we're hoping for. One thing to still kind of note on that as an asterisk, SAFE doesn't guarantee uplisting.
Yeah. But right? CLIMB had some language on it, right?
Well, so CLIMB was literally what we're talking about. That was meant for uplisting and unlocking equity for the entire cannabis industry. But so CLIMB is great, but CLIMB is, you know, two guys in the House. You know, it's never passed the House, right? So like, if we can't even get SAFE banking, I mean, CLIMB is kind of a dream. You know what I mean?
Oh, exactly. No, CLIMB is definitely a dream. I think the only positive that I really saw from it was that there was explicit language on uplisting, right? So it's kind of like saying, hey, listen, because SAFE didn't have that.
Well, so interestingly, SAFE has gone back and forth. They've inserted capital markets protection and they've taken it out again. So the latest version seems to have no capital markets protection. The theory goes that if they passed it, then they would update their FinCEN guidance, and that would give cover to the exchanges to do it, right? But ultimately, it's sort of like hoping, you know, you kind of have to hit a bank shot to get it, right? You got to get SAFE, then you got to get the FinCEN, then you got to get the exchanges to sign on, right? So
gotcha.
So, you know, that being said, look, there have been basically no IPOs this year, right? Like, it's not like banner time for the exchanges right now. Like, I think they are hurting. So now, is that enough to move the needle for them? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But that's a, in my opinion, a better backdrop for us than, you know, last year when every crazy, you know, tech company was IPOing and doubling,
like, or every SPAC.
Yeah, right. I mean, they don't need that cannabis business, right? But now I think it's looking more juicy. And that's why I go back to this idea of like, even I'm pretty negative, I think pretty clearly on equity markets in general. But I do think cannabis is kind of decoupled. Like it's traded pretty far down. I don't really see any industries, although I don't look that much, but I haven't seen any industries trading at like sub 5-6 times EBITDA, right? For some of the best companies. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there right now. And I think over time, you know, looking ahead to 24, there's a lot of opportunity for these companies to get re-rated more to that 12 to 15 times EBITDA, not this 5 to 6 times.
Yeah, yeah. But couldn't that kind of go back to the whole fact that there isn't that whole institutional access to institutional capital who would step in? Like, remember, like we've had this discussion multiple times about, you know, sure, tech has that bottom because just the level of capital that kind of steps in. They say, hey, look, listen, I like this company at XYZ multiple. We don't really have that in cannabis, right? There just isn't that many players.
Yeah, absolutely, right? And that's why I say in markets, anything can happen. I mean,
yeah,
nobody has to step in on the big boards either, by the way, right? If you keep getting, you get a couple more bad CPI prints and you turn the Fed funds rate up another 2%, right? Like, then we'll see what happens to those institutional buyers in the public markets of NASDAQ stocks, right? So I agree with what you're saying, Abby. Like, there's no guarantee that even if these companies start killing it or are trading at 3 times EBITDA, nobody has to buy them, right? But I'm just a big believer that over time, if people think there's an opportunity to make money, they find a way. They get interested in these companies and they come into them. But clearly, federal legislation is the biggest catalyst, biggest sector-wide catalyst, no question. Right. But when I think of
more so than uplisting, that's
well, that's what I mean, though. Federal legislation leading to uplisting. Right. So if people think there's movement on that, that's when they go hard at it. Right.
Oh, gotcha. I thought you meant federal. Sorry. I heard federal legalization.
Yeah. Sorry. I meant legislation with regards to uplisting. Right.
Right.
That's obviously the big kahuna. But the point is, in the meantime, like me as an investor, I feel a lot better about buying these things if the fundamentals are going in the right direction.
Right.
Which they haven't been for the past few quarters. And I think that's going to change with Q2.
Yeah. You've voiced that quite a bit, especially with the new markets coming online, right? Select names, right?
Yeah. But now that being said, if we don't get SAFE this year, if this whole SAFE Plus thing fails, which would be an epic failure on Schumer's part, if that happens. But if that happens, we could really get chopped away at the knees. So it's hard to sit here and say, even though, you know, like a lot of these companies are really interesting, it's if you have a lot of exposure already, like I do, it's hard for me to say, oh, hey, go buy more, right? Because although I like the valuations, like if nothing happens on SAFE, which is kind of what I'm planning for, like you could really see the bottom fall out of these things. And then I think you come in and have to buy some up just for the opportunity in the low cost base.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, Abby, coming to the end here, right? So we're talking about price rediscovery and, you know, people trying to figure out kind of how to navigate markets. Any final thoughts you'd like to leave people with?
I mean, like, listen, we there is actually one article that I wanted to kind of allude to that I've been looking at this week. So remember, I think it was a month ago almost now, or 3 weeks ago when we went on the air, I was telling you I started sort of aggregating a bunch of news just to sort of see where things were going, right? Trying to get like a sentiment check because I was beaten down quite a bit and I was like, hey, is everybody else beaten out of the headlines sort of saying that and then looking for trends? And so, you know, I started seeing Europe kind of come more and more and more, and Europe was sort of being painted as this like growth story for cannabis, right? Today, I think it was today or yesterday. No, it was today. Today, Bloomberg put out a article saying recession to wipe out weed firms trying to make a quick buck. And it was an article specifically focused on cannabis startups in Europe, right? Because they're having an extremely hard time raising capital just due to recession fears and market downturns, which, you know, obviously we could kind of see that from happening. But, you know, as I was starting to read that article more and more, it kind of got me thinking back to sort of the early days of cannabis. And if I wasn't where I was today from 2018 till now, if I just entered now, you know, I would have read that and been like, they say, hey, Europe is going to be a 453 million euro market, right, by 2026. And it's like, well, is it really? You know, that's a pretty big market. How are, like, and kind of going back into like, how are these small startups really going to capture that market, right? And then you you start digging a little bit further, and they're thinking that the UK market, right? So UK just a standalone is going to do about $1.2 billion in the first year of legalization. And it's like 2026 is only, what, 4 years away. Like, you know, how many markets have to come online for them to actually hit that that projection, right? It's a very lofty projection. Mm-hmm. Anyways, it just sort of really reminded me of early days of 2018 or 2017, 2018, like pre-legalization on Canada. And then just seeing that, hey, look, the article was sort of not contradictory, but the article sort of kind of went on both sides. Like, hey, like, there's a really massive market, but these high growth, high flyer companies are having a hard time raising capital to sort of capture that market, right?
Well, and growth is in huge quotation marks because these companies are all speculative, like,
yeah,
speculative on top of speculative. Like, you don't know what the rules and regs are going to be in Europe. You don't know when it's going to come. You don't know, like in Germany, for example, it's a market I've looked at several times. Super interesting market, right? I mean, 80 million people, right?
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, like, who's going to be allowed to grow domestically in Germany? There's a UN convention preventing imports in Germany, right? Like there's all kinds of things that it's like, you're kind of like, it's very hard to actually know how it's going to look. So either you're buying into something that maybe will go public and just trade like the Canadian stocks did, right? On pure hype. Or you need to wait and see what the regs look like, right?
Yeah.
Or you're investing in something and getting such a low valuation, you're taking a flyer on something.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this article was saying that, hey, that hype trade is not really there anymore.
Right.
Right. So that's what's making it difficult.
But saying that, put an asterisk next to it, I bet you if you had some kind of pure play German company, and IMCC IMC, either one, is you know, based out of Israel, but you know, they've got a pretty interesting German play as well. But if you had some kind of public way to play that, like on a pure play basis, I bet you as Germany got closer to legalization, you would see some opportunity there, right? Might have to move on it. Like, you might have to sell it on the right day to really get a good return.
Yeah.
Right. Like, it might be short lived. But I do think, like, I think even in a down market, and I think a down market could last a while, there's going to be these opportunities and pockets of people chasing what they see as like a catalyst driven opportunity, like Germany legalizing or something.
Well, so that's funny that you say that because, so, you know, I focus a lot of time in Canada, small cap, high risk, high growth capital markets, right?
Yeah.
And just going back to what you were saying about, you know, people are still trying to look for the next growth catalyst. The only deals that I'm really seeing getting like done or across the finish line, even though they're not getting fully funded, are solar deals or EV deals, a little bit on the critical metals, but mostly circular like economy deals are the most recent ones that I've seen getting funded. And then if you recall back in the summer, a couple of years ago, we started talking about ESG a little bit, and that was kind of like a big in vogue buzzword that was kind of getting thrown around. Those companies were getting from some lofty valuations, even though they are feeling the pressure on the secondary market. And when I say ESG, I'm not talking about like large cap names like FedEx starting to do a social governance report. I'm talking about like companies that came out, started selling carbon credits, right? Mm. They're starting to feel pressure. Like, you can see them, you know, they're down from their IPOs. But I've seen a couple actually do some deals. They completed some financing. So it just kind of gets me, you know, That part just kind of gets me thinking of how growth capital really thinks. You know, there's this opportunity for cannabis, which has which could be backed by at least some sort of asset class that has that growth potential. But yet, because this is easier to like more palatable right now, that because there's, you know, solar is like the future is what they're touting in terms of battery storage and sort of energy and sort of battery storage, etc. These companies are getting filled, right? And I talked to somebody about it, and they said, "Listen, it's easier to sell a dream than it is to sell reality." Mm. And that's like stuck with me. And I was like, "Man, the reality is cannabis is now a reality. It's not a dream anymore."
Oh, right? I love that. I love that. Another good one I heard. I'll leave you guys with this is I was talking to somebody on the real estate side, and you know, he was freaking out a little bit, and he said, "Look, like we're going to have to start underwriting lower values, right?" And he goes, "But." He goes, "Look, I always remind myself when things look bad, you know, the bears sound really smart, but the bulls make all the money." So it was just a nice. Yeah, I just love that quote that, you know, yeah. like it's easy to come out and be negative and, you know, that there's a time and place for that. Right. But yeah. ultimately it is the Bulls who make the real money in this game. So it's not just about being, it's about being realistic, but it's about finding the places where you think we can still hit the ball out of the park, even if that takes a little longer than you might think. That's where the money is made. Right. So, yeah. So it's easy to be negative, especially in what I think is a down market, but keep looking at the deals and figuring out what your spots are.
Yeah. And dude, this after hearing that, I'm pumped, you know. I'm going to go to the park. I'm going to go to the park and start picking up some cigarette butts and start seeing if they have one drag left, you know.
Attaboy. All right, everybody, cinpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time.
This podcast is a general communication and entertainment being provided for informational purposes only. It is educational in nature and not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment product, strategy, plan, feature, or other purposes. Any examples used in this podcast are generic, hypothetical, and for entertainment purposes only. None of Cannabis Investing Network or its affiliates are suggesting that the listener or any other person take a specific course of action or any action at all. Communications such as this are not impartial and are provided in connection with advertising and marketing of products and services. Prior to making any investment or financial decisions, an investor should seek individualized advice from a personal financial, legal, tax, and other professional advisor that take into account all of the particular facts and circumstances for an investor's own situation. By listening to this communication, you agree with the intended purpose described earlier. Opinions and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions constitute our judgment and are subject to change without notice. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors.